Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to Series 2 of my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen. A podcast made in collaboration with my great friends, the amazing charity Help Musicians. Joining me tonight is a singer-songwriter whose future was shaped after seeing Elvis Presley on the cover of a magazine. He then learned some guitar and started playing in the folk clubs of New York. He recorded his first album, Tapestry, which was paid for out of his own pocket. A year later, he released one of the most remarkable singles, American Pie. But his music didn't die, as he's been recording and touring ever since. So please welcome the very wonderful Don McLean.
I can hear but cannot see.
I was going to say, that's a great line for a song.
My eyes are dim, I cannot see. I did not mean for you to sing, but only that my eyes are dim. It's a funny parody the Weavers used to do of Amazing Grace, about a preacher who would come in and first he'd sing Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound, and then they would answer, amazing. And then he'd come in, he said, he forgot his spectacles. And he says, my eyes are dim, I cannot see. My eyes are dim. He says, I did not mean for you to sing, but only that my eyes are dim. I did not mean. And finally, this is no way to sing at all. I think the devil's got you all. And they sing that. I think the devil's got you all. Hardy har.
So, Don, welcome to this little podcast. It's for...
Oh, you're the squeeze man.
I'm the squeeze man, and I'm doing a podcast.
Oh, I love that group. Thank you for having me on your show again. Oh, I mean that.
You're welcome. It's for Help Musicians, which is a charity that gave out £19.3 million to struggling musicians during lockdown. Is there such a thing in America?
No. America does not believe in... We are supposedly the lift yourself up by your bootstraps country, but it's not true, of course. There should be. In fact, I always thought that all of these public domain songs, that there should be a fund, you know, to go in to create a fund for, you know, struggling musicians who need something, who are working. You know, you got to differentiate between people who play the guitar and don't do anything and then people who are real musicians. But
When you were a child growing up, was there much music in your house?
No. My home was not a house that had a lot of laughter in it. It was... You know, my mother and father were somewhat serious. My father had a temper. My mother had a temper. I was sort of trying to get out of the way. And I discovered a bunch of 78s that were left over when I was like 5 years old, I think. They used to have a big console that would be, you know, a piece of furniture. And in it, you know, would be the record player on one side, the radio on the other. Big speaker, though. The speaker sounded good.
Yeah.
And then there'd be a little place where there'd be old 78 records, you know, 78 RPM. I guess it's before 55, 52, 51. I started to get into those, and there was a Gracie Fields record of Now Is the Hour. I don't know. My mother must have liked that one. And I remember hearing Gracie Fields... And so that was my beginning, and then radio. And then as I grew up and got older, of course, Elvis came along, and that was a big game changer. Because then as he came along, I think the top 40 radio became more powerful in New York City. There were three top 40 stations, and the delivery system of those stations was, you know, really... very powerful. So we all were focused on the top 40. And then I would sing. I loved this stuff. You know, I was really loved the music, and I loved it very much. And then one day I saw Elvis Presley on the cover of TV Guide, and he had a D18 Martin guitar and a red shirt on. And I said, boy, that's what I want to do. And that was the start.
So it must have been an incredible feeling to be around in those days when that was just kicking off.
You know, it really was, because there were two things that were happening. More than two, but a two that I remember. One is that the music that we were getting was our music, mostly. The top 40 had everything on it. So you still had Sinatra, you still had Percy Faith, you know, with the Summer Place, but you had, you know, Gene Vincent, and you had the New Guys, you know. So it was a wonderful mixture. And I think that is really what's in my head, is all that stuff put together. I think that I carry that kind of top 40 in my head. And the other thing that was fascinating was that kids started making their own music. We started getting banjos and guitars out of the attic that had been there. Grandpa had put them away, you know, and all of a sudden we wanted them.
Yeah.
And I had, I must have had 10 guitars in my house that I got out of other kids' attics. You know, they would let me have them. They didn't want them, but everybody started playing music. So music was starting to be made by kids, you know, rather than professional musicians. We were ear musicians. Everything was learning, you know, how to play by ear. And that's where the folk thing was very, very helpful, because, you know, but we really didn't separate them. It was all one thing. You know, you listen to the Kingston Trio, or you listen to the Beatles, or you listen to if you like some, you know, the Five Satins, the Dovells, whatever it was, you know, you listen to all of it.
Did you ever see and feel the reaction that that kind of music had on girls that were around at that time?
Because
I know when I was growing up, it was a major thing.
Well, I started playing, I can tell you from personal experience, that I started playing, and I was maybe 16 or 17, and I was desperate to make money, so I was already teaching kids what little I knew. I was teaching them and getting money for lessons. I had a couple of really pretty little girls that followed me everywhere. They were in love with me.
Wow.
I had groupies, and I wasn't even known because they picked up on me. And I was around town, you know, I was playing little things and whatnot, but they were, and they would come out of the woodwork. And by the time I got famous, I'd see a sea of granny glasses and hair parted in the middle, and they were pretty, you know. And there were thousands of them everywhere I went. And I was in my own world, you know. I was just a serious musician, a serious poet and artist. I cared about what I was doing. It was a lot of distraction, I'm telling you.
So it was more of a female audience that you had.
Yeah, it was a thing. They liked the poet. I was pretty, you know, and I sang the way, you know, I guess in a way that that they particularly liked, you know, in that particular area of music. And I mean, I had 120,000 people at Hyde Park, and there were girls were taking their shirts off and throwing stuff at me, and I was. I was confused by my effect on people.
Right.
The album, the first two or three albums, coupled with my physical appearance and my sound and whatever, had this effect on people for a while. And it was fascinating. I enjoyed it. I'm glad it didn't last too long.
Okay. And did it influence the way that you wrote songs?
No, it didn't influence the way that I wrote songs, but the whole experience changed me. You know, I wasn't as good a songwriter after the Don McLean album, I think, the third album. I think I was sort of very tired. I saw what it was. There was a lot of adult stuff that I had to deal with, lawyers and, you know, I don't know, just, it was too much for me. It was only me. I didn't have a group, a bunch of guys, you know, where I could sort of go along with it, you know, but it was just all on me. And that's why I made playing favorites. I didn't want to write songs. I sang a bunch of songs I liked, and I had the Mountains of Mourne became number one in Ireland. They still asked me to sing that. And then I went back to, you know, I did Homeless Brother and started writing songs again. I had a nervous breakdown about 1974, around there. I couldn't leave the house. I was pretty messed up.
Have you had somebody that's been throughout your career that you can lean on, somebody you can talk to?
No. No, I was always on my own, kind of.
I think a lot of songwriters are on their own anyway. They kind of have to find their ability to write songs, tell stories. They need that separation, I guess.
Well, I think, you know, if you want to write songs, you're going to have to suffer. If you want to suffer, they have women out there to help you do that. You know, and then you write songs about falling in love. You write songs about falling out of love. You write songs about betrayal. You write songs about motherhood. You write songs about, I don't know, all kinds of things. But it's all really women and suffering. I think that's basically a big part of songwriting, because you want to get the beauty and the femininity and the love and the warmth and the togetherness, and you also have to get the pain and the suffering and the, you know, when it ends and things are horrible and how it colors everything and how it makes it impossible to go on, and then somehow you find a way to go on. It's all drama, you know, around this.
It is drama, yeah. But at this end of the corridor, is that behind you now?
Oh, I don't think anything's ever behind me in my life. You know, I mean, I was 30 years married, and then a whole thing blew up, and I don't even know what happened. And then I found a new love and a new life, and I'm having a wonderful time, the best time of my life right now. So I suppose I should have died in my 60s. It would have been I would have been beloved by all.
Oh, my God. What was it like going in the studio for the first time? Was that in New York or was that in Los Angeles? Or where was it?
The first time was in Berkeley, California.
Okay.
And there was a man named D'Souza who ran a studio called Sierra Sound. Mm-hmm. And I was produced by a young man named Cherry Corbett, who had been a member of the Youngbloods. He was a bass player in the Youngbloods. And he was a really nice person. And he didn't want to be on the road or be in a group anymore. They'd had Grizzly Bear. They'd had Get Together. They'd had some, you know, and he wanted to try producing. So he produced Tapestry. And he liked me. And I stayed at his house, and his house was in Marin County, and it was a beautiful wooden house, and the smells were gorgeous. There's a whole different smell of that area in San Francisco, rich mosses and undergrowth, and, you know, and you could look down into a valley, and it was way down, like several thousand feet. And every morning, one of the guys from the Army would have a plane go over and he'd break the sound barrier. And a big explosion would go off and you could see him go by. And Jerry, you know, I didn't know how anyone would react to my music. On this album, I had a song called General Store, which was about two people talking about a lynching or some kind of a civil rights thing, but in a matter-of-fact way, in a general store. I had a song called Magdalen Lane, which was really a precursor to American Pie in terms of the song, the lyric style I was fooling around with, and it was about Los Angeles. I had a song called Tapestry about the environment. Then I had a song called Castles in the Air, which was a very commercial type of a song, and another one called And I Love You So, which became a big classic song and a very important song for me. But I didn't see it that way. You know, I wanted to go in, and I had Orphans of Wealth about poverty. I wanted to do Orphans of Wealth with a bass and guitar only and sing it, you know. But I wanted 40 strings on And I Love You So. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't know how this fellow was going to react to all this different stuff that I wanted to do. But he was just totally cool with it. He loved it. And then I had strings on other things. I had strings on Castles in the Air. I wrote a song called Bad Girl, which is a really kind of an interesting song, you know, about a girl kind of gone wrong and then, you know, a sort of a fade out and thinking back to how she was as a little girl. And I always see that with people, you know. You know, you ever see the movie The Conversation? It's a Francis Ford Coppola movie with a Gene Hackman. And it's the story of a guy who's a he's a man who plants bugs, and he's brilliant at all this planting bugs and things. He's a, I don't know what you call him. But anyway, they're going to kill this guy, and they overhear this conversation, and the woman is always saying, yeah, but I always remember how he must have been as a little baby, because he's a homeless person or something. And I was thinking to myself, I say that all the time, you know, why did... How did that little person go from being so loved to being in this fix that he's in now, you know? You know, I often think about that. And I think one of the things you've got to have are rules. You've got to have rules. You've got to have standards of some sort.
Yeah.
And my dad was tough. And he passed away when I was 15. But by God, you know, I got something from him. Because I have some standards.
Yeah. So he brought you up with a kind of loving embrace, but he brought you up with good manners.
No, it wasn't a loving embrace. He was a distant Scot, but I knew he loved me.
Right.
But, you know, there was the truth, and then there was this other stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that is the thing that really, you know, stuck with me, you know.
Yeah.
I used to tell my children, I said, look, don't guess. Either you know the answer or say, I don't know. You know, but people have to come
really
up with
thing.
Something. Why? It's wrong. You know?
Yeah, yeah, really. That's really cool. In every episode of I Never Thought It Would Happen, we hear from an artist who's benefited directly from Help Musicians and learn a little about their experiences and the support the charity provides. Please meet James Adrian Brown, the former Pulled Apart by Horses guitarist and now an electronic artist and composer who's based in the Yorkshire Dales. James starts by describing the high point of his career so far.
I think the first time we were booked to play Leeds and Reading Festival on the main stage, you know, I went to every single Leeds Festival every year and would always be at the main stage and just in awe of the whole thing. And, you know, when we first got asked to do the main stage and being on the other side of the barrier and walking onto that stage, I was just like, oh, wow, this is crazy. I'm on the other side of that barrier. You know, the gig was amazing. I remember I felt like I shouldn't have been there. We were like wandering around. I was like, I'm going to get told off in a minute. I'm going to get like my pass taken off me and thrown off stage. But no, we were allowed to be there. When the sort of gigging thing stopped, it was like, I have to do something. What am I going to do? I can't sit here just, you know, waiting, essentially. Yeah, it's very difficult. And those mental health problems will become worse. When you lose routine, you lose what you do, and you're not reaping benefits and rewards from what you do, it's going to start affecting you mentally. And I just kind of lost my way, essentially. It was Nadine Shah who put me on to Help Musicians. I think it was in Newcastle at a Suede gig or something. And I remember just doing a bit of clicking and having a look round. And I think more than anything, it was reading stories about how Help Musicians had helped other musicians. It almost felt like it was like this sort of like, there's a lifeline there if I need it. You know, I wasn't even aware of what Help Musicians did. I knew it was there, but I wasn't aware of the support. You begin to see the light, in a sense, that there is something there that can help you and give you a bit of guidance, really. Maybe I can do something to carry on being musically creative, and things just progressively got better, and I started doing other things, composing for TV and doing some production music and some films and TV stuff, and then that led into me doing my own sort of electronic music, and now I'm here, and I feel like I've come a long way in this past year and a half, considering where I was, you know, in March 2020. It was a really, really dark, strange place. It felt like it was like there's no hope. And now I'm like, wow, this is really cool. I've learned a lot and I'm doing things I've never done before and wanted to do. One of the worst things about this whole situation is, unfortunately, a lot of people have just given up doing music. Sometimes some people can only take so much of a battering, but it's kind of sad because you don't know what will have come of those people in the world of music. They could have gone on to do like amazing things. I mean, the Spotify thing, I mean, I could go on about that all day. It's really difficult because it's an incredible tool. You can discover music left, right and centre, and you can, everyone all over the world can discover bands that might not necessarily heard on the radio. But when you're given this tool and you can pay a small fee and you can listen to anything in the world, unlimited plays, there's no going back from that. How can they better having all of the music in the world at your fingertips? You don't have to pay individually for each thing. It's like, wow, I think, you know, we're stuck here. And, you know, hopefully they will sort out royalties and stuff and payments to artists. But even if they slightly change royalty rates, we're still not going to make any money from streaming. The damage has been done.
You can discover how to support Help Musicians and you can find them on all social media platforms, or you can go to their website at helpmusicians.org. So when you go in the studio now, do you still have the same sort of expectations, the same ambitions?
Well, I wanted to say something about that. I got sidetracked. But going in the studio originally was terrifying because everybody was a better musician than I was. But it was my record, and they were my songs. Mm-hmm. And I had my vision, but I had to look guys in the eye who didn't care one way or the other. It was just a job to them. Mm-hmm. I hated that. And so I would really take my time to make sure that everything was just close. Castles in the Air did not turn out the way I wanted it to, and I redid it with Larry Butler, and it became a hit record.
Yeah.
And it's because Butler wanted to do it. He said, please let me record this song. It hasn't been done right. And boy, he knew what he was doing. And I love that, you know, when you're in the studio with people that know more than you and they can help you and they want to get you something. And boy, that's a thrill. You know, that's hard to find.
It is a thrill. It is.
Isn't it? That's why you have a George Martin. I mean, there wouldn't be a Beatles without the George Martin. I mean, he would make music out of nothing. A little fragment or something. And all of a sudden, it's like an anthem, you know.
So if you're in the studio now, do you feel really connected to the songs that you're writing now?
Well, I do things a whole different way now. I write songs and I sing them into my phone, and then I record a version of it with my guitar, which is how I would have done it, and I send it to my friend Mike Sievers, and Mike will start to create a track. So he does a lot of it. And then I'll suggest this or that. I want this person on it or whatever. And then we'll get a bunch of tracks, and then I'll go and do the vocals personally. And then I'll add my acoustic on so I can drive it into or make it or play it, however. So it's still a Don McLean record, but it's not in the studio at all. You know, and it's a shame because... First of all, the studio was like the camera. The camera did not lie. The studio did not lie. Now, the camera lies and the studio lies. They're both big liars. They're both the biggest goddamn liars of all. You know, this camera is a complete lie, you know, with photoshopping and all the other things they do. And the studio is a big lie, too. But you'd go in there. I mean, I went in there with all these heavyweights in New York City making American Pie and... You know, a lot of drugs, a lot of attitude. And meanwhile, I didn't care, you know. I did not care. You were going to do this. I didn't care if I had to go outside and have a fist fight with you. This was going to be the way I wanted it. And I almost did have a bunch of fist fights with Ed Freeman, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he was brilliant, but he could be a condescending guy, and I didn't like that. And so, you know, we would, you know, but he was terrific. You know, he did it. And he said something in this movie about the day the music died, the story of Don McLean's American Pie. He said, we fought, but we were determined on one thing. We weren't going to leave that studio till we had a masterpiece, and we didn't.
Do you think there's a Don McLean musical?
Yeah, that's going to happen. The same guy, Spencer Proffer, who has done the bookazine, which is this.
Oh, nice.
It's a thing that was sold, and it also talks about the day the music died. This is the pathway, really, for the movie right here. So you can see all these pictures of me as a young boy and my parents here. You can
beautiful.
Get a picture of my father. If you can see a warm embrace there. You see my dad?
Yeah, I can see.
You see that, my father right there? That was my father. He's a great guy, but he wasn't the embracing kind of fellow. He'd never been embraced himself, you know?
Different times, though.
In the movie, you then are there with film footage, and everything recreated. It's almost like it comes to life, and it's the story of my life, really, and the story of that particular album, but even the ones before and after, it's all part of the same thing. It took 10 years, really, for me to write American Pie, because I waited. I carried the Buddy Holly thing with me always. There was always something special about the pain. I felt pain. Again, suffering. And then finally I was taken by Pete Seeger to the Newport Folk Festival in 1969. And it was the most amazing experience because a man landed on the moon while we were all at this weekend at this festival. And all these heavyweights were there, James Taylor and, Kris Kristofferson, and all people who were just getting started. Van Morrison.
Of course.
I was part of this little group. And the Everly Brothers were the star, and they were not usually at a folk place, you know, because they used to have, like, folk people. And Pete Seeger was a wonderful musician. He was classically trained. He really had a great ear. He was a wonderful, very interesting man. But most folk singers were horrible. You know, they sang out of tune. They played badly. They were just shit, you know? And the Everly Brothers were on stage, and they were the most consummate professionals.
Yeah.
And they rocked that place. I'm telling you, they'd never seen anything like it. They killed them. They had Larry London on drums, and they had their guitar player, and those guys were swinging. I mean, they were just amazing. Well, afterwards, I walked up to one of them, Phil, who I thought was probably the most approachable. I had read and read about Buddy Holly. I said, what do you know about, can I ask you about Buddy Holly? I mean, I know you knew him. Can you tell me what happened? And Phil was, you know, very nice. He waited a moment, and he said, well, Buddy took the plane because he had to do his laundry.
That's right.
And when I heard those words, I said, say that again. Yeah, he had to get ahead of the bus in order to do his laundry. He'd be on stage that night, but he had to get a few hours to do the laundry. He did other people's laundry too, not just his own.
Yeah.
Because that's why Waylon Jennings' wallet got sent back 20 years, 30 years later, because he sent him his pants and the wallet was in it.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, so now all of a sudden I'm thinking, it just started everything going. I started thinking about my boy as a man, as a person doing, you know, making a living, you know, like I was doing, you know? And it wasn't an album cover anymore. It was alive. And so I went back home and I sang right into the tape recorder this long, long time ago thing, right to the day the music died. The whole thing. The melody, the words, everything in the tape recorder. And I said to myself, I've got it. I did it. I captured it. And now what am I going to do with this, you know? And I spent a long time thinking about that. And I could have gone a lot of different directions. I could have repeated. I could have said a long, long time ago, and I could have done, the day the music died, and another time I could have done, and said, the day the music died. I could have stayed there with that somehow.
Yeah.
But it would have been a half-assed ballad. I didn't want a ballad.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I got to get out of this thing somehow, and I got to take this. So I got to find a crazy chorus and rock and roll. I want a rock and roll song. So I found this crazy chorus about a month later. And then I sped up the slow part and knew what to write. And it took me an hour and a half. About 3 months later, I wrote the whole thing and slowed down the last verse so it would be like the first verse. So you have elements, really, of popular music. You have a vamp and a coda. Mm-hmm. Then you have folk music, which is a verse and chorus, but you have rock and roll, which is the beat of the whole thing.
Absolutely.
So all three, those are the only three kinds of music that I understand. I don't know nothing about anything else.
It's an extraordinary story and an amazing song, obviously. Do you think the music has died again with technology and Spotify?
Yes. I don't think you'll ever... You know, Joel Dorn, my dear friend, said to me, you know, people waiting for the big bands, they're not coming back. Because that's the theory of the song, is that the population out there with their morals, their education, their level of intelligence, their caring for one another, all of that, by our institutions, create the leaders, create the artists, and create the criminals. You know, create everybody, you know. So how did you get, and this fascinates me, how in the world did you get out of the ghetto somebody like Duke Ellington? That's the thing I cannot figure out. But some way, Duke Ellington benefited. Even though he was broke, he wasn't poor. You know, in the old days, you know, these guys all knew jazz and everything. They were home. You know, maybe they didn't have any money, but they were listening to every band, and they wanted to get in that group, and they practiced like crazy so they could play with Benny Goodman or with, you know, Count Basie or whatever. It's a fascinating thing. And the people with no money today are poor. The old days, people with no money were broke. There was a difference.
So the music has died.
It has. And the best thing, and the thing I can guarantee you, is the computers will make much better music than is being made now. It will be a renaissance, but computers are going to do it. They're going to pour everything in there, Bach, Beethoven, Paul McCartney, you know, whoever, and they're going to come up with stuff that will knock your socks off. I'm not kidding.
Really?
Because...
But you know, I would rather hear you pick up an acoustic guitar and sing a song than listen to a computer play a song.
I know, but unfortunately, you know, the socialization process is going to embrace this, and they're going to embrace, you know, the Lone Ranger was created on a radio station, and they didn't even know what he looked like. And so eventually they had kids wrote in, and they said, well, we want your picture. So they had to take a guy, his name was Brace Beamer, and they had to put him on a white horse with an Indian sitting behind him, and photograph him with a mask, because they invented all this without ever having the guy. And they would take a picture of Brace Beamer on the white horse with Tonto behind him. They invented it all, and the theme song, the whole bit. Well, they're going to create music, and it's going to be by somebody. And and people are going to know, well, I want a picture of, you know, Zago or whoever it is. They're going to have to create him because he ain't going to be there. And it's going to be the same thing as the Lone Ranger. Yeah, it's going to happen. I guarantee you.
That's a wild thought.
And they'll be socialized to this. And this Zago, whoever he is going to have a career and continue on and make all kinds of music. Yeah. And with this hologram stuff, he's going to be on stage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like ABBA.
You know it. I mean, if 10,000 people will stand in front of some idiot spinning records, he's jumping around, he's putting his hand, he doesn't have any talent. They're out there. And they call that entertainment. I say a computer can do better than that.
Well, I hope not, because I would rather see somebody play an acoustic guitar.
Well, yeah.
Full of love and joy.
But that takes practice, you see.
Yeah, that does take practice.
You know, that's what you know about. You know, having a group, you've got to practice. You've got to be good at what you do. They don't want to practice.
No, that's true. Well, Don, I've only been allowed 30 minutes to speak to you, and I want to thank you so much for being here.
I loved your questions. Anytime you want to talk to me, I'd love to talk to you.
It means the world to me. Thank you.
I love your group. I love that group. I have at least three of your albums.
Thank you.
And, you know, I love talking to you. You really know what you're talking about. And, you know, and you ask very good questions. But it was terrifying going in the studio when I was young. You know, it really was. I had to fight everybody.
I understand, totally. Well, hopefully I'll see you on the stage somewhere here in the UK sometime soon.
I wish you would come by. I'd like to have a beer with you and sit and talk.
Let's do that. God bless you, Don. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, that's all we had time for. Unfortunately, we could only speak to each other for 30 minutes as he was so busy. But I'm very grateful that he was able to take the time. It strikes me that we have a lot of things in common. Time spent as a teenager learning guitar, and weeks or even months spent carefully crafting lyrics and words. And the thrill and the stress of making our first record. But unlike Don, I've never had Madonna cover one of my songs. At least not yet. There's still time. To find out more about the wonderful work Help Musicians do, have a look at their website for loads more information. And please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Please keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.